Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. It was 53 years ago this week on August 2nd, 1967, that Grand Central Terminal was granted landmark status. In the announcement, it said, quote, Grand Central has always been a symbol of the city itself. It had its own aura, its own ecosystem, created in part by the people who worked there. The job of the red cap attendant originated at Grand Central in 1895 and soon became a model for railroad stations across the country. In New York City, red cap attendants were a combination of a porter and a metropolitan encyclopedia. They were responsible for carrying riders' luggage to and from the train, as well as fielding questions about train schedules and directions to places throughout the city. The workforce was mostly African-American men. And at a time when Black Americans had to fight for work opportunities, red capping became a coveted job and a source of pride for those who held the position. And that was largely because of a man named James H. Williams, who became Grand Central's chief attendant and first African-American officer in 1909. He served in the role until his death in 1948 and became something of a living legend with lots of friends in high places, as well as an integral figure in the Harlem Renaissance. He was part diplomat and part mentor, yet his story hadn't really been told in full until now. Historian Eric K. Washington is the author of Boss of the Grips, The Life of James H. Williams and the Red Caps of Grand Central Terminal. This summer, the New York Academy of History chose Boss of the Grips as one of two winners of the 2020 Herbert H. Lehman Prize for Distinguished Scholarship in New York History. Boss of the Grips was also listed as one of the 10 best biographies of 2019 by Open Letters Review and honored as one of the 10 favorite books of 2019 by the Bowery Boys New York City History Podcast. Eric joined us last fall to discuss his book, and I asked him, what was the Red Cap system and how did it work?
The red cap system started, as you said, in 1895, not with African Americans. George H. Daniels, who was the general passenger agent of New York Central, sort of the publicity generator, and he started with a dozen men, all white men, who were bi or multilingual. This was to accommodate, you know, a polyglot cosmopolis. Sure. That New York was, but also to serve rather as gallants, sort of knights in shining armor. So if women were traveling much more on their own, and it was considered somewhat hazardous when they were coming into a big city because they would fall prey to perhaps bunco men. I'm not sure what that is, but it doesn't sound good. So they were supposed to sort of act as helpers.
Squires,
yeah. Sort of. So, you know, I'll hold the baby for you while you've got your packages, or I'll hold your small package. Not really to be porters, and this was emphasized, who were considered really, in New York terms, schleppers, you know, who would really be burdened. Mm-hmm. That quickly changed, and I think if you were white, you could be promoted up into a system, into another department, or get another job. Certainly if you had language skills, those are transferable to other occupations. And the level of disgruntledness accelerated rather quickly among that group. And within about 8 years, in 1903, James H. Williams was brought in. He must have been recommended by, we're not really sure who recommended him. It's very likely it was this florist who he had worked with, who was Charles Thorley. He was one of the most noted florists of the Gilded Age. But it must have been a recommendation on the highest authority to have a black integrate a white system. And there doesn't seem to have been any notable protest, which would have been common. So it was probably a planned thing where the white red caps were moving on to other departments or whatever. And James Williams was in the system within a year. It's almost entirely black. And whatever happened at Grand Central, if you think of Grand Central to American railroads, what Central Park is to America's great parks, everyone's watching and everyone's emulating very quickly what's going on there. So if they have a black railroad porter at Grand Central, they're going to have it at Penn Station and other railroad stations across the nation. So this happened very quickly. And it quickly turned into a rather, because it was steady, a job that was coveted by young black men.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you stop for one moment.
Yes, sure.
Somebody I think is thinking, is this a Pullman porter are we talking about? Can you explain people the difference?
Yes. So the Pullman porters were also African American, and they began, you know, shortly after the Civil War. Many of them were formerly enslaved. Mm-hmm. And this was a system, these were sleeping car porters, but Pullman was the company they worked for. So for short, they were commonly called Pullman porters. And the difference, the short answer is the Pullman porters rode the rails, the Red Caps worked the stations. So they were kindred in that when James Williams came on and it became an all-black crew, they were kindred spirits and had kindred issues because of race. But that was the basic distinction. Another distinction would have been that when you think of Williams as a labor organizer, part of that organization was getting people in the door, getting the job, because it's rather hard to. The Pullman porters were famously organized by A. Philip Randolph in 1925, and they were working on, you know, collective bargaining issues and workers' rights. So, preceding that period, in that period, you know, when in the first decade of the 20th century. Up until then, getting the job was really the key part of organization. It was more fraternal and grassroots kind of organizing. It's hard to complain about job conditions. I mean, you can complain if you don't have the job.
Right.
And that was sort of. But then, you know, eventually they would organize themselves in the same way, and they used the model of their brethren, the Pullman porters, around 1940.
So you mentioned that this was a coveted job, being this Red Cap porter. So who sought out these jobs?
The average Joe, mm-hmm. who needed work, because it was there and you could make money. They were largely working only for tips, unsalaried, but it was also convenient for students, black students. And Williams, although he had never gone past grammar school himself, was very, very enthusiastic about the idea of young men trying to accomplish something for themselves. And so he, not exclusively, but expressly, hired lots of black students. And they would often come from Southern schools like HCBUs, but also from Northeastern schools and also local schools, so some Ivy Leagues, where they were like maybe the one and only black student. And it was oftentimes in this situation, schlepping bags, you know, that black students from different regions actually got to meet each other. And they represented all disciplines of interest. So many of them went on to become names that we still recognize, like Paul Robeson, Adam Clayton Powell Jr. But they were doctors, lawyers, clerics, educators, Broadway stars, athletes, really a cross-section of everything that you see in terms of occupations in the living world.
My guest is Eric K. Washington. The name of his book is Boss of the Grips, The Life of James H. Williams and the Red Caps of Grand Central Terminal. So let's talk about Mr. Williams. He's born in New York. It's fun. Your book can actually be kind of a walking guide.
Yes.
Because I saw that he was born at 227 West 15th Street.
Exactly.
So I went to visit this morning before I came.
Oh, it's still there.
The door is purple.
Yeah.
Now, it is still very much there. And I thought, oh, would there be a plaque here? But to your point is, you know, people don't know about him.
Exactly.
So tell me about his family, who he was born into.
Sure. Both of his parents were from the same county in Virginia. They were both formerly enslaved. I wasn't able to find anything to suggest that they knew each other because counties are big. So they probably met in New York and married in New York. His father, John Wesley Williams, was a hotel waiter. And when he gets here, he's living in one of the most notorious parts of town. Now it's luxurious. It's Greenwich Village, you know. But it's
Thompson. Was it Thompson?
Thompson Street.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was one of those areas that, you know, Jacob Riis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How the Other Half Lives. You know, focused on. But he also, while he's living there, he's got this job in this really posh hotel, the Sturdivant House, which is not there any longer. It's where the Ace Hotel is now on that site. It's a different building on the same site. And that was the center, like Broadway, Fifth Avenue. It's part of that whole Ladies Mile mm-hmm. district where there were a lot of hotels and theater, the Floral District. So there was that kind of dichotomy of where he lived. His mother was a laundress, and he was born in that tenement that I couldn't afford to live in now. But,
I know,
but
it was a block from Google.
Yes, yeah. And probably his two older sibling had been born in the same apartment. And then they moved. They lived, you know, in this sort of amorphous area that was known as the Tenderloin on the west side there, mm-hmm. in the going upward of 14th Street to about what we called, you know, Hell's Kitchen today in the 50s, before Hell's Kitchen was more centered around 39th Street and 40th Street. And so those were his beginnings. And his father's a worker, and he's probably working because kids worked mm-hmm. as well. And they... he worked for many years for this florist, Charles Thorley, where he very likely got a lot of his supplementary education in terms of meeting people of different classes, of different races. Mm-hmm. Thorley was a whole other phenomenal figure, but he was said to have really popularized the idea of giving flowers. We say it with flowers, mm-hmm. Long stem roses, but presented like in boxes, like gifts.
Oh my!
Orchids, the violet craze. You know, all of these things, and you can imagine Williams just being able to look in the ledger to see who's ordering what on what occasion for birthdays, for funerals, where are they sending flowers to.
So
he was a messenger.
So he gets a cultural education
exactly.
about New York and
yeah.
class, and that's interesting.
Yeah. And Thorley was also known for hiring in his shops a great number of African Americans. So these shops would have been centers. They would have been nexuses for communication, for mm-hmm. whatever's going on in the African American community, for people to talk to each other. And if you have a job like he has, he's a florist, a floral messenger. So you want to send flowers to somebody, you give them to James or whoever the other messenger is, and he takes them. And you don't just, you know, people make conversations. You're walking into a house, you see where people are living. You may have noted in the book, there's one picture where he's in a tuxedo and he's sitting at this famous studio of photo studio of Otto Saroni. Saroni was right next door to Thorley's mm-hmm. shop. So he probably knew not only the photographer and his group of photographers who worked there, but possibly, you know, delivered flowers to somebody who was sitting for a portrait or whatever. He knew the celebrities, Maude Adams, the actress, yeah. and, you know, that's...
So he probably, it sounds like he took this cultural education and really applied it to his work as a Red Cap, because he rose up to the top of the Red Caps.
Yeah, because he started in 1903, and then 6 years later, 1909, he's made the chief attendant. And the reception among the other attendants seemed to have been very positive. You know, they gave him, the expensive gifts and everything. Mm-hmm. But he had this unique position because everybody's traveling. Everyone's traveling by rail then, high and low. And of meeting people and being sort of the one that people sort of, you know, when you go somewhere, you go to a restaurant that you like, you settle on a waiter or a waitress who you kind of like, or you go to get your hair mm-hmm. done, and it's just like, well, Molly's not available. Will Denise do? No, I'll come back with Molly. You know, that
yeah.
sort of thing. So he was the favorite Red Cap of a lot of people. And I think many people really measured their journeys, particularly on the famous train, the 20th Century Limited, where he was the first face they saw at the gate when they were leaving mm-hmm. or when they were coming back. So you kind of measure your experience in the railroad in that sense by the familiar faces. People also wired him, say some of the, you know, the elite people, like, you know, my daughter's getting out of school for vacation. She'll be coming into Grand Central. Can you meet her and make sure that she gets on a train? And these relationships, because you can imagine he's there for all of this time, he's watching people grow up who know him like family. Mm-hmm. This is a key role that's appreciated in the Black community, because when things need to be done, influences need to be brought into the picture, Williams is one of those people who has the capacity to do that.
Go see Mr. Williams.
Exactly.
He'll help you with X, Y, or Z.
Exactly.
You describe Williams as part of the central nervous system of the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, you know, a lot of these young men who are working these jobs to defray their school costs They're actually going to school and they're studying things mm-hmm. that will make them the movers and shakers of this storied era. Lester Granger is one of them. He's a social worker. He becomes head of the National Urban League. Mm-hmm. And he's influential when the Red Caps start organizing along the lines of the Pullman Porters. Broadway star Richard Huey, he's one of the workingest black actors on Broadway, from Porgy before it's Porgy and Bess, Abraham's Bosom. He gets that mm-hmm. show when he's, it's a Pulitzer Prize winning play when he's working as a Red Cap. And Williams didn't want to hire him, actually, but he happened to have a letter at his disposal from W.E.B. Du Bois.
That'll work.
And it did, yeah. But he always looked back. He said, you know, this was a move up when I got this job as a Red Cap, you know. So these were people, you know, and this was in 1925 when he comes here. So this is sort of the height of when the Harlem Renaissance is being called that, being labeled that, yeah. And all eyes are on Harlem. So in that sense, Williams is really keyed in. Plus, he's keyed into all of the earlier generation who are the progenitors of the generation of young people who are making names for themselves during the Harlem Renaissance. So he's part of that radar. Yeah.
That was my conversation with historian Eric K. Washington about his book, Boss of the Grips, The Life of James H. Williams and the Red Caps of Grand Central Terminal.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.